surprise. He recovered quickly and looked back to Reese.
And then there were two, Zharkov quipped. He had just outgrown his usefulness.
Reese chose his next words carefully. Mr. Zharkov, I have a proposal for you.
I am listening.
Get me out of Russia, to CAR. I'll find my way home from there. In the meantime, I want you looking into everything you can find on Nizar Khatan, the Syrian sniper who helped take out President Zubarov last year. You must still have contacts at the SVR. Use them. Get me something actionable.
Don't you have the CIA?
Nizar was employed by a Russian through a Syrian proxy. I think you might have better access.
And what do I get out of this little agreement?
Asked the Russian, ever the dealmaker. Reese looked at the tomahawk in his hand. In the short term, I won't skin you alive. Longer term, you will have a back-channel connection to the CIA.
Are you offering to spy for me, Mr. Reese?
No. I am offering you a way to contact me. I'll run any request you have up the chain, but know that even that access could be extremely valuable to you and your organization.
And if I don't agree?
Then there's my short-term fix, Reese said, giving the Winkler Seok a spin in his palm.
You Americans are too trusting, Mr. Reese. How do you know I won't agree and just have you killed when my detail arrives, or change my mind a month from now and send hit teams to kill you wherever you are?
Because you are a practical man. I killed your son for you, and this alliance will help us both. If you have your men kill me, I have a friend who is even better in the woods than I am. Your son killed his sister, put her head in a bottle of formaldehyde. He'll finish you off, and trust me, he won't be as kind about it as I would be. And if you betray me later, I found you once in the middle of Siberia. Don't think I can't or won't do it again. I kind of like it out here. The elder Zharkov weighed his options.
I accept your offer, Mr. Reese. My son was a killer. We are hunters. I give you my word that no harm will come to you. I will guarantee your safe passage as far as Africa. From there, you are on your own.
And, Ivan, if you fuck me, I'll track you down and kill you in your own kitchen. Not only that, I'll kill your sons. All of them. I will erase the Zharkov name from existence. Your legacy will be that an American wiped your bloodline from the earth. Epilogue. Deep in the forest, a call was sounding. Jack London, The Call of the Wild. Baltimore, Maryland. Reese waited on a darkened section of street, rain pelting his rented Chevy Tahoe half a block down from the long-term storage facility in Baltimore, Maryland. The engine was on to keep the defroster working, but his lights were off. The facility was ringed in barbed wire and security cameras. Signs advertised a guard. He observed the entrance for an hour. No one came or went. It was open 24/7, if you had the right keys and an ID. Reese had waited until well after midnight to cut down on the number of people he might encounter. In this part of the city, that didn't necessarily make it safer, but Reese wanted to be alone. He'd been back in the States for 6 weeks, debriefing at an off-site CIA annex in Northern Virginia. They needed him close by as they figured out what to do. A team of American mercenaries, well, technically not mercenaries as none of them had accepted payment, had invaded a sovereign country and killed the Russian deputy director of their foreign intelligence service, who just happened to be the son of the head of one of the most powerful organized crime syndicates in Russia. One of these mercenaries had stayed behind and traveled deep into the interior, killing an American defector from the Central Intelligence Agency. Everything was being kept very low-key, as the CIA and executive branch figured out how best to play it. The Associated Press had picked up a story of the slaying of a Russian intelligence official that first appeared in the Moscow daily Rossiyskaya Gazeta and on television from the state-owned news agency Novosti. The mafia-related assassination received little mention from U.S.-based mainstream media, who were all much more concerned with the circus surrounding the upcoming presidential election. Receiving even less attention was the admission of a red-haired male to a Level 2 trauma center in Anchorage with a mysterious piece of shrapnel in his leg. Alaskans were notorious for serious injuries that came as a matter of course as a result of the inherently dangerous professions that drew people to America's 49th state. The emergency surgery that saved his life was even covered under TRICARE. In a not-so-random visit, the White House log indicated that the day the mercenaries departed for Russia, the director of Central Intelligence made an unscheduled 3 o'clock a.m. visit to the president's residence. A meeting took place in the Situation Room, a meeting in which only two people were present. It lasted 30 minutes. The next hour, an Ohio-class special operations-capable SSGN submarine was diverted from a national tasking off North Korea and positioned off the coast of Russia. Because of the sensitivities that enshroud the subsurface fleet, this move went unnoticed and unreported by military and intelligence watchdogs. In the weeks since Reese's return, prominent D.C. lobbyist Grant LaRue had mysteriously gone missing. At the same time, the president's chief of staff, Reginald Pine, had resigned, citing personal reasons. Journalists and conspiracy theorists had yet to connect the two events. True to his word, Ivan Zharkov had used his illicit network to deposit Reese on a dusty airstrip in the Central African Republic. The CIA chief of station in Bangui was more than a little surprised when an American who looked like a homeless mountain man appeared at the front gate. Calls were made, bona fides were confirmed, and Reese found himself on a secure video teleconference with Vic Rodriguez. To the director of clandestine services' agitated and probing inquisition, Reese simply answered, "Just get me home, Vic." Police sirens stirred Reese from his reverie, the blue and red flashing lights screaming by on the way to yet another call. Reese turned on the lights and put his SUV in drive, approaching the front gate and waving to the guard, who manned the facility from behind a horizontal sliding barrier. The guard hit a button, and the iron gate rolled out of the way, allowing Reese to inch forward.
"Can I help you?"
"I'm looking for container 1855. I haven't been here in years. Can you tell me where it is?"
"Name?"
"Thomas Reese." The guard scrolled through a database, confirming that Thomas Reese had a container in the storage facility and that he was fully paid up. Finding everything in order, he asked for Reese's ID. Reese pushed the ID through the open window of his vehicle, intentionally holding his finger over the first name. The guard yawned, consulted a map, and drew a circle on it before handing it to Reese and pointing into the labyrinth.
"Take your first right and then the next left. It'll be about halfway down."
"Thank you," Reese said. The lone guard nodded and went back to a night of monitoring security cameras, drinking lukewarm coffee, and eating stale donuts left over from the day shift. Reese drove slowly past row upon row of storage units until he found himself parked outside number 1855. When his mother had passed away, the last of his family's belongings had been sent to Katie's father. The Baranics were listed as the next of kin after Reese. Because Reese was believed to be dead, 3 boxes had eventually been shipped from his mother's nursing home closet to Dr. Baranek, who ultimately sent them to Katie to give to Reese. Katie had been none too pleased when Reese turned up at the U.S. Embassy in the Central African Republic 6 months after she had seen him off. When he had not returned, both Rafe and Jonathan had paid her a visit. They had been smart enough to call ahead so Katie wouldn't think they were arriving to give her the news that Reese was dead. She'd lived that nightmare once before. Reese thought he would be welcomed back with open arms, but found, much to his dismay, that Katie was pissed. Though the making up had been worth it, they decided that Reese should have his own place, as he was debriefed at Langley and figured out his next move. Rodriguez wanted him full-time at the agency, but Reese needed time.
Time to figure out this next chapter in life. His next mission. Purpose. Rhys had waited until he was alone to unpack the boxes of memories from the nursing home. As he worked his way through old family photos and mementos from happier times, he'd come across a cigar box containing some military photographs from Vietnam, his dad's DD-214, the paperwork everyone who has served in uniform since 1950 has received upon discharge from active duty, and an envelope containing a key. An address was printed on the envelope, the address of the storage facility. Rhys stood in the pouring rain outside the storage container and rubbed the key in his hand. The journey that had started with the death of his father in a back alley of Buenos Aires was finally over. The miles logged and bodies stacked since that pivotal moment had chiseled Rhys into the warrior he was today. Why, as he stood in the rain looking down at the key, did he not feel a sense of closure? The man behind his father's death and the killing of Freddie Strain was now in the ground, just fertilizer for the Siberian tundra. The traitor's death begot life. Looking right and left for threats, Rhys carefully inspected the corners of the roll-up door with a handheld light, then checked the area around the lock before kneeling down to work the brass key into the old master lock. It took some maneuvering to get it in and twist it, the mechanism fouled with years of grime and dust. True to form, it clicked open and Rhys slid it from its post. "What secrets are you hiding?" Rhys wondered. He could have used his agency contacts to look into who was paying the monthly fees, but Rhys didn't want to alert the most powerful spy agency in the world that one of their former case officers who died under mysterious circumstances had a storage unit set up to outlive him. Rhys wanted to see what was inside first. He pocketed the lock and key and pulled up on the door. As with the lock, it took a bit of work to get it up to knee level, at which point Rhys squatted down and pushed it up. Darkness. Rhys retrieved the light from his pocket. Out of habit, he held it in his left hand, his right remaining free to go to the gun, if need be. The light moved slowly from left to right, revealing an empty shelving unit on the left and a tarp over what appeared to be a vehicle. He approached with caution, walking around the car and looking underneath it for anywhere the dust was more recently disturbed. It had been backed in. Tom Rhys Combat parked, just like his son. Seeing nothing that set off any alarms, he went to the front left corner and pulled back the cover. Rhys couldn't help but smile. There, looking none the worse for wear, was his father's 1985 Grand Wagoneer. The tires were low and the left rear was clearly flat, leaving the old Jeep much like a football player past his prime, sitting on the bench waiting for that one last play. He wiped the driver's side window with his sleeve and peered through with his light. Looking at the handle for anything that looked cleaner than the rest of the vehicle, he pressed the button and slowly cracked the door. Shining his light up and down the broken seal, he examined it for anything unusual, particularly wires. Once again, all clear. Pulling the door all the way open, Rhys used his light to inspect the front and passenger rows. Sliding into the driver's seat, Rhys put his hands on the wheel, remembering. He then leaned over and opened the glove box, rustling through some oil change receipts and a tattered owner's manual. Craning his neck, he looked in the rear seats. Nothing. Maybe Dad just left me an old Wagoneer? No. There is something else. Thomas Rhys wouldn't take such pains to ensure a storage unit in Baltimore would receive monthly payments 15 years past his death so that someone could one day discover an old Jeep rotting away. Rhys exited the vehicle in which he had so many wonderful memories and walked to the back of the classic truck. The window was down, and Rhys suppressed a chuckle. He'd learned more than a few swear words listening to his old man curse the notoriously inoperable motorized backsliding window that had to be down before opening the tailgate. Rhys depressed the button on the back of his tack light and looked into the storage area. An aluminum rifle case
gleamed back. Even all these years later, Reese remembered exactly how to drop the gate. He reached inside and pulled up on the handle, assisting the drop into position. "What did you leave behind, Dad?" Reese whispered. Positioning the case across the gate, Reese inspected the clasps. A small travel lock secured the contents. Reese hesitated briefly to take a look at every point where the rectangular case might have been tampered with. Again, clear. Putting his light in his mouth, he pulled his Winkler Dynamis Combat Flathead from his back pocket, a tool that looked like the most aggressive screwdriver in existence. He inserted it between the shackle and body of the lock, aggressively pulling back on the tool, and snapped open the padlock. He then flipped its closures and opened the box. There, lying in the foam cut out to keep it secure, was a duckbill-modified Ithaca 37 shotgun with a pistol grip and canvas sling. Reese pulled his father's weapon of choice as point man in the jungles of Vietnam from its resting place and examined it. With the extended tube, Reese knew it held 8 rounds. 4 boxes of number 4 shot were nestled into the foam. That's it? As much as Reese admired the tried-and-true Model 37, he had expected something more. A truck and a 12-gauge? Something didn't fit. If his dad wanted to leave him a Jeep and shotgun, he would have just left them in his garage. The top left corner of the box caught his trained eye, the foam just a bit out of place. Reese pinched it with his fingers and pulled the top layer out of the case and onto the rifle, a key and a letter falling out with it. Intrigued, Reese went for the key, a safe deposit box key. Reese rolled it in his fingers and inspected it in the light. Nothing to show where it came from. The letter. Reese reached for it. Sealed, he turned it over in his hands. It was addressed to James Reese in his father's hand. A message from the grave? Reese broke the seal, pulled out the letter, swallowed hard, and began to read. He read it quickly at first. Then he went back to the beginning and read it again, hearing his dad's voice breathe life into the words that leapt from the page. When he was done, he slowly refolded it and placed it back into the envelope from which it came before putting it and the safe deposit box key in his pocket. Then, moving back to the front of the old truck, he took a seat behind the wheel. He watched the rain hitting his Tahoe and the ground around it, each drop an attempt from Mother Nature to cleanse and refresh the world below. Reese stared out the window in a self-imposed trance, his car illuminated every few minutes by a crack of lightning, losing track of time as memories of his father, his mother, the old wagoneer, Buds, his wife and daughter, Iraq, Afghanistan, Siberia, Freddie, Nizar, and Katie, the living and the dead, passed through his mind's eye. Pulling a burner phone from his pocket, Reese pressed in a memorized 10-digit number, hit send, and brought it to his ear. The director of clandestine services answered on the first ring, and Reese gave Vic his answer.
Savage Son, a thriller, was written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter. It was recorded by Tim Moore at York Recording Studios in Los Angeles, with editing and post-production by like 2,000 pounds. The associate producer was Claire Tadakoro. Savage Son was produced and directed by Travis Tunn. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Savage Son, a thriller, is available in print from Emily Bestler Books. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, True Believer, a thriller, written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.